Good morning, and welcome to the July 1st edition of Mountain Money. I'm your host, Roger Goldman. I'm joined this morning by a guest co-host, Ronna Tatton. Good morning, Ronna. Thanks for being here.
Good morning.
Ronna, what have we got coming up?
Today on Mountain Money, author Julie Sato will discuss her new book about the key role that women played in the development of the modern department store. It's called When Women Ran Fifth Avenue.
We will then journey from Fifth Avenue down the coast in New York to K Street in D.C. and speak to author Brody Mullins about his book on the evolution of lobbying, The Wolves of K Street. All this and more this morning on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Hello, listeners. We're interviewing author Julie Sato about her newest book, When Women Ran Fifth Avenue. This is predictably about women and American fashion, but the breadth and depth of early department stores is surprising. Julie Sato takes her readers on a lovely walk through how department stores rose from the general store to glitzy and practical women-centric goods and services. It is fascinating that despite world wars and economic hardship, society, primarily women, craved beauty and well-made goods to dress themselves, better their status, and be more comfortable and respected. This book follows three colorful entrepreneurial women and their creative visions and knowledge of what women needed and wanted to buy. From roughly the 1930s to the 1980s, the department store was a women's world and a respected career choice, although men still were heavily in management and society struggled to make women both revered and reviled for their successes. I wanted to start with the question for Julie. Good morning.
Hi, how are you? Thank you so much for having me.
We're happy to have you. How did you decide that there was enough information to write this book highlighting the three women?
Yeah, it's a great question. None of the women that I focus on ever had biographies written about them. So you're right, there was that question in my mind when I started out, how much I'd be able to find. But luckily, yeah, there was more news articles during their lifetime. There were some PhD dissertations written about them, various things I was able to cobble together. I hired a genealogist to track down some living relatives, things like that. So I managed to make it work.
How long did it take you to do that research? And what made you think this was a project you wanted to undertake?
Yeah, it took about 3 years to research and then write it. And I would say about two of those years were really spent researching, and then the last year maybe writing it. I always wanted to tell women's stories, and I personally love fashion and have lots of great memories of going to department stores with my grandmother, things like that. But I was really shocked when I started to research it, and I realized that it was this female-centric universe where these women could have these really fulsome careers at a time when that was so rare, and that women consumers also had sort of the power of the wallet that they didn't have in regular life, but they did have in these stores, you know, over the male clerks or managers, etc. So I really loved that power dynamic. And then when I found these three characters, I was just blown away by how amazing they were and how, you know, how their stories really reflected actually the history of the 20th century and the history of American fashion and of the history of the department store. So...
Well, I thought it was also interesting that one of your main characters, Hortense,
yes.
Who ran Bonwit Teller, was a Mormon woman from St. George, Utah.
Yes, sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, that's right. She was amazing. She grew up in St. George. Her grandparents were early converts to the Mormon religion, and they were some of the first white settlers to the area. And she really grew up, you know, in a pioneer town, very far from Fifth Avenue and the department store. She made her own clothes. They grew their own food. And through various things that happened and her marriage to Floyd Odlum, they ended up up in New York during the Great Depression, and he became one of America's wealthiest men during the Depression, which was very rare. And he owned the Bonneteller department store, and he was going to close it. But obviously, during the Depression, that would have meant a lot of people out of work. So instead, Hortense went there. She had never had a paying job before. She was a mother, a stay-at-home mom. She began working in the store, and she started to realize all these things that they could do to really turn the business around. And in 1934, she became the first woman ever president of a major American department store. And she made the business, you know, the powerhouse that it became. So she was really an amazing person.
She really was. But I was surprised that you said in her autobiography how she decided she wasn't that proud of her business achievements and felt that it had just so much interfered with her family life. So I wondered if it was very difficult to strike a balance in telling her story.
It was actually one of the hardest ones of the three women, I felt like, to kind of understand her as a modern working woman, to have compassion and understand how challenging it was during her era. And she did end up really coming to resent her work life. She was never comfortable with being a quote-unquote businesswoman. She did not like that phrase. She did not use it. She liked to compare herself to a wife hosting her husband's, you know, work colleagues to dinner for a dinner party. That's how she sort of saw being president of the department store, that she was a host welcoming guests to the store. And she was very uncomfortable with her career. And she did end up really, you know, having a lot of confusing feelings about it, which was challenging, unlike the other two women. So, you know, I think we have to understand her historic context for where she was coming from.
By the way, one of the most fascinating vignettes in the story is this image of her walking into a meeting that her husband is having with some colleagues about what to do about Bonneteller, and they sort of look at her and go, hey, why don't you go walk around and see what it's like? I mean, it's a magnificent image, and it seems like something out of a movie, which sort of leads to her role.
Yeah, I mean, if only. My fingers are crossed. Hopefully someone wants to make it into a movie. But that came from her autobiography. She's the only one of the three women who actually wrote her own memoir, which I used heavily for the book. Although, you know, like a lot of memoirs, it wasn't like completely accurate, I should say, that she made things appear much more rosy than maybe they were. But some of that dialogue was so wonderful, and I was able to utilize it in the book, which I was so grateful for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Ben Dulles. It was a smaller department store that took a much more measured approach to building the store by creating something with almost kind of like a mini small town row of stores within a large store. Was this sort of the predecessor to the modern American mall?
I do think it was. Geraldine Stutz, she came from outside Chicago. She had a very strict Catholic upbringing. She came to New York as a fashion editor at Glamour magazine. And essentially, this man who had a big shoe company plucked her out of the magazine, and he eventually bought Henry Bendel's, and he installed her at age just 33 in 1959 as president of Bendel's, which was a very traditional, very exclusive store. But it had come on very difficult times and was not doing well. And as you mentioned, it was this very small store and couldn't really compete with the Bloomingdale's or the Macy's of the world. So she came up with this idea to create kind of what she called a street of shops, which was essentially like an indoor mall, but a very elegant one, where you would walk down a paved road on the main street, the main floor of the store, and on each side were these beautiful little boutiques selling individual things, whether they were, you know, stockings or hats or jewelry, cosmetics, and you could just shop in the little stores. And, you know, today, if you go into Target, for instance, and you see like an Ulta Beauty, you know, boutique within the Target, for instance, that was really her creation.
It's so interesting. There are many what might be referred to as side stories of the successful artists and creators of goods that elevate like the store windows and so forth that are just fascinating. Are any of those maybe bigger stories that may become some other books?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out my new book idea. But yes, I called them sort of vignettes. I felt like there were so many stories that were not completely related just to the three women's lives that I focus on, but were so important for telling the larger history of the department store and of American fashion. So I couldn't help it. I included these vignettes. And, I do think, you know, they're so fascinating. I have one about the history of the mannequins, or as you mentioned, shop windows that many of us may recall, like the Christmas windows, or, you know, I have one about the first black-owned, female-owned department store in Richmond, Virginia, which, you know, was the seat of the Confederacy, and it happened right after the Civil War. So really fascinating stuff. So, yeah.
We want to get to the shavers, but I want to start by with talking about another vignette that, again, struck me as something out of the movies, which is these two sisters go to New York and create a bunch of dolls. Can you tell us that story?
So the third woman I focus on is Dorothy Shaver, and she arrived in New York City from Mena, Arkansas, which is a tiny town in Arkansas, with her sister Elsie. They were in their early 20s. This was 1919, so this was before women even had the right to vote, and they only had a suitcase between them. And Elsie was an artist, and Dorothy was much more business-minded. And the girls really didn't know what to do. They wanted to stay in New York, and they had to figure out how to get jobs. So Elsie started creating these dolls, which were called the Five Little Shavers. And they were these very unusual, beautifully made, handmade dolls. And Dorothy, with her business acumen, began selling them. And before long, the two women had their own store, and they were doing an incredible business. This was in the early 1920s, running this doll company. And eventually, Dorothy gets a job. You know, her sister gets sick of making the dolls and wants to go back to her artwork. And so Dorothy ends up getting a job at Lord and Taylor in 1924. And by 1945, she had worked her way up and became the first ever female president of Lord and Taylor. So it was a huge accomplishment.
So Dorothy Shaver was very visionary. I mean, she had dental care for the employees and education and training, and she thought of child care for the customers so they would spend more time and stay longer and spend more money. Do you think that someday we may see stores circle back to some of these early concepts of customer luring and retention and employees?
Gosh, I hope so. I mean, I should say that, yes, these early department stores were nothing like what we think of department stores today. They were really worlds unto themselves. As you mentioned, some had dentist offices. They had, obviously, the hair salon and the lunch, you know, the cafes and all of that. But they also had nurseries where you could go and drop your children off, you know, to eat ice cream sundaes while you went shopping. They had, some had miniature zoos. They did incredible publicity campaigns. I mean, one even had an adoption week where they essentially had five infants up for adoption as part of a publicity stunt. Just incredible things. And they were, you know, these worlds. And I don't know, you know, I'd love to see that again. I mean, obviously, being able to go into this place and have all these options to buy candy or have your nails done or buy, you know, fancy clothes. They were also, you know, you didn't have to only buy fancy clothes. They also had very affordable things, all sorts of different price points. I think that kind of thing is sorely needed still today, you know, as we all shop online. So, you know, I think it's much harder financially to make that kind of business work in today's world. But I do hope that there might be a return to them in some form or another.
Let's talk about fashion. You know, early in the book, you talk about Hortense not being able to find something to wear for her first business dinner. What were the influences that these department stores brought to bring fashion to women of New York?
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, it had always been in the 20th century that, you know, in 19th as well, that fashion was in Paris, that the idea of America and fashion just were you know, it made no sense, that didn't exist. In America, all we had was really the garment trade, which was essentially large, big manufacturers that were taking Parisian designs and knocking them off for an American mass market. So making cheap copies. And you're right. Hortense in the 1930s said, gosh, women don't want these cheap things. We see right through that. Make us, you know, simple, well-made, well-tailored clothes at an affordable price point. And this was during the Depression, so obviously that was very important. The everyone was on a serious budget. And so she really helped do that. But it was really Dorothy Shaver in many ways that helped create what we know of as the American fashion industry. Because in those years, she was the first one, Lord and Taylor, under her leadership, was the first one to begin naming American fashion designers. There were American fashion designers. No one just had ever heard of them before Dorothy Shaver. So she really started to put in Lord and Taylor advertising, dresses made by Claire McArdle, for instance, you know, an early American fashion designer. She created an American fashion department in the store. And then during World War II, when Paris was invaded by the Nazis, you know, really essentially that closed down the market for America. And all of a sudden, there was really a need for American fashion designers. So that was really when things started to grow in earnest. And essentially, you know, we have sportswear, we all wear leggings, all those things. That all came from the American fashion look. It was called the American look, and it was sportswear, what we think of today, because in Paris, they all only had haute couture, you know, very fancy things. So it was really a great American invention.
And Geraldine Stutz was also so instrumental in curating special looks for her clientele at Bendel's, but it did seem to trickle down. And do you think that the constant churn of finding something new and getting it out there, it sort of devolved in the 80s into this, like, we're all supposed to wear sweats sort of mentality?
True, sadly.
It's fascinating how they did so much. But there's also the men who are on the other side who hired the women in the first place and promoted them. But these women always made much less money throughout their careers, and it still persists today. But was there any evidence that these men ever knew each other and somehow worked together?
So, yeah, I mean, if I could have written it as fiction, I definitely would have had the characters all, you know, coming together in a big climax. But I do believe that the characters knew of each other, potentially. Dorothy and Geraldine knew of each other, but I don't think they ever really worked together. And you're right, like, Geraldine also had a really big impact, I should say, on American fashion, because she really helped create prêt-à-porter, or ready-to-wear, which is essentially, you know, as I mentioned, Bendel's was much smaller than the other department stores. So she really sent her buyers out there and said, go find unusual fashion designers that no one else is looking at. Go to the side streets and find them and bring them back to the store. So Sonia Rykiel, Stephen Burrows, these really important designers in the 60s and 70s were all who she founded. And she really helped create kind of the way that we wear clothes today, which is in regular sizes and stuff. That prêt-à-porter market she really was a pioneer in that. But yeah, and then the men, I think, are very important, because all three of the characters really wouldn't have been where they were if they didn't have male mentors. So they each did have, you know, men who really helped pave the way for them, you know, but they did it very much on their own. And as you mentioned, with the pay disparity, for instance, Dorothy Shaver, so Life magazine wrote a profile of her, and they named her America's number one career woman. And she earned the highest published salary that we know of for a woman of that era. She earned about $1.65 million a year in today's money, but that was still significantly less than the man she replaced, and that was true up until the end of her career. So absolutely, that pay disparity was there. Even though they broke a lot of ceilings, there was still a long way to go. And as I say in the book, you know, we've all heard of Bloomingdale's and Macy's, the men's names were on the building, but inside, the women ruled. So that was the the idea for the book.
And let's flesh that out a little bit, because I think it's interesting to talk about the sort of work structure within the buildings. Women ruled in the sense that they were the customers, but talk a little bit about the way in which the employment structure worked, that the women were typically at the clerk level. How did it work?
Yeah, for sure. As I mentioned, these were huge businesses. They were not, they had 2,000 employees. And there were very strict hierarchies. So women were often, the sales women, obviously, that was a key role for women. But there were these employee training programs, and they took them very seriously. And you could really earn your way up. You could really move up the ladder. The highest level were the buyers. And these were incredible women who ran very large departments, frequently managed, tens to dozens of people beneath them. They would go to Paris several times a year to the Parisian fashion shows. They were very, very important for the way American women dressed. I mean, they really dictated that. So I have a vignette in my book, for instance, as far back as 1906, I had a woman who was in San Francisco, and she started out as a dust girl in 1906 in a department store in San Francisco. And, she lived in a poor tenement with her family, and within 10 years she was a very powerful buyer. She had earned enough money that she bought her family a very large home, moved them out of the tenement, was supporting them herself. She's a single woman in her 20s in the 1910s, taking a ship to Paris, to Europe, to the fashion shows. I mean, that's an incredible thing, and most people don't know that. And these stores really provided those opportunities, to have careers like that.
In the fictional Mrs. Maisel series, they show her working in a department store, and there are incredibly strict rules for the women who work there, behavior rules. Was that the case in reality?
Yes, it was a really, they had their own cultures. Each department had its own culture. I talk about this book that was published in 1929, that's sort of like a Jacob Riis, How the Other Half Lives, about the tenements. She did this for department stores. This woman went undercover for 2 summers and worked in department stores, and then wrote this book called The Sales Lady. And it was all about that, the sort of culture that each department had. They would have their own language, their own terms that they used, their own cultures. And it was really, they were very competitive with one another, but it was really, they also worked together, and there were really strict rules, such as, you would get fined if you said the wrong thing to a customer, or, you had to stand the entire day during your shift, no matter if there was a customer there or not. You couldn't sit down. But on the other hand, the department stores had things like on staff chiropodists who would massage the saleswomen's feet and help care for them because they were so tired standing up. So it was a lot of rules, but also they really cared for the employees.
Well, we're running out of time, and we didn't quite get to the rise of the Walmarts, the Targets, and the Kmarts, but everybody should read this book and find that out. It's been really fun to hear about your book, When Women Ran Fifth Avenue. And thank you so much for being on Mountain Money today.
Thank you so much. This was so fun.
We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to Mountain Money. The names Paul Manafort and Roger Stone are familiar to many Americans due to their involvement with the campaigns of Donald Trump. But unlike Trump, Manafort and Stone had been denizens of Washington for decades. Black Manafort and Stone was just one of several firms that transformed the way that powerful interests affect the way government functions in this country. In their new book, The Wolves of K Street, The Secret History of How Big Money Took Over Big Government, authors Brody and Luke Mullins trace the evolution of lobbying and the way in which both Republican and Democratic lawmakers became increasingly pro-business. We're lucky to be joined by Brody Mullins this morning. Good morning, Brody, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, Brody, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take you to do the research?
Yeah, great questions. The research from the time we got a book contract to writing took a couple years. But, I've been a reporter covering Washington and businesses and lobbying in D.C. for 25 years. So, a lot of the stuff that's in this book has come from, more than a decade of reporting on corporate America. And really what motivated us is, we realized that, know, when people go to school and learn about how the government works, you learn about the interplay between the three branches of government and how that inherent tension creates rules and regulations in Washington. But no one talks about corporate America and the influence that corporate America has on laws and legislation. And what we realized, you know, what I've seen covering Washington for many years is that companies oftentimes have as much influence, if not more influence, on laws and legislation than the President of the United States or even members of Congress.
You don't see corporate America on Schoolhouse Rock.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, sometimes you learn about the role of the media, how the media influences legislation, but no one talks about corporate America and interest groups. And it's really stunning because right now, so many of the important laws and legislation are crafted with the help and support of companies.
Well, to get a little specific, you profile Tommy Boggs as essentially the godfather of the modern American lobbying industry.
Exactly.
Who was Boggs and how did he operate?
Yeah, Tommy Boggs, we consider the first sort of modern lobbyist, the first lobbyist in the modern era, that is sort of the post-1970s era. Boggs was the ultimate insider at a time when inside connections and relationships with key members of Congress could be successful in Washington. Tommy Boggs was the son of Hale Boggs. Hale Boggs was a House Majority Leader, a Democrat in the House. He was the number two House Democrat on his way to being Speaker of the House. In 1972, his plane disappeared in Alaska, where he's presumed dead. To replace him in Congress, the citizens of New Orleans elected his mom, Lindy Boggs, who was a member of Congress for almost 20 years. So Tommy Boggs grew up with both members of Congress, both parents being members of Congress. LBJ and JFK would come to their house for dinner. He knew, you know, all the important people who made laws and legislation at the time. And at the time, it's important to say, before Watergate, only three or four or five people in Washington really mattered when it came to legislation. The president, the Speaker of the House, the Senate Majority Leader, those were the guys, and they were always guys, who got together and made legislation. Tommy Boggs knew all of them. So when he decided to become a lobbyist and signed up big corporate clients, you know, he knew all the important people who made laws and legislation and therefore was very successful.
You know, Tommy Boggs comes from this world of traditional New Deal, you know, liberal values. And at one point, I think he in the book, you describe how he ran for Congress. But as his career evolves, he moves away from those values and starts to talk about how he starts advocating positions that are kind of in contrast to the policies being championed by his father.
That's one of the more fascinating things that it happens. Actually, our book is about four or five different lobbyists, and a couple of them have the same transformation. Tommy Boggs' parents, I mean, his dad was in charge of moving lots of the, he was a New Deal Democrat, but when he was a senior member of the House, he was in charge of moving many of the Great Society programs through Congress. I mean, he was a champion of liberal causes. He was a very rare Democrat from the South who supported civil rights. So he was really a champion of sort of the modern liberal movement in the 1970s and 60s. And then when his son comes along, his son all of a sudden is advocating on the other side. And that's, you know, a tension that we found amazing, that his dad sort of helped create the modern liberal pro-worker, pro-consumer federal government. And his son was paid top dollar to dismantle those same rules and regulations. It was really sort of an amazing change.
Yeah, while we stay with Boggs for just a minute, talk about the kind of establishment he built.
Yeah, so, you know, Boggs was one of probably the most senior non-elected Democrats in Washington. He was the key to Democrats raising money from companies, from corporate PACs for Democrats. He raised probably more money for Democrats over 20 years or 30 years than anyone else in Washington. At the same time, when a company needed access to an important House or Senate leader, they would go to Tommy Boggs. So he was sort of at the center of the intersection between big government and big corporations, and that made him incredibly, incredibly powerful.
So during the Reagan administration, it was Black, Manafort, Stone, and Atwater. Did they all have similar backgrounds?
Yeah, that's a fascinating turn was the 1980 election. When Reagan got elected in 1980 and took office in 1981, for decades, Democrats had been in charge. In fact, Congress was held by Democrats for almost 50 years before the 1980 election. In the 1980 election, not only is Ronald Reagan elected, but Republicans win control of the Senate for the first time, all of a sudden companies said, oh my gosh, we need access to these Republicans. Who are these Republicans? And Charlie Black, Paul Manafort, and Roger Stone knew the Republicans. I mean, they were the Republicans who had access to the Reagan administration because they had worked on Reagan's campaign. Before Reagan won, as I said, Democrats controlled the House for 50 years. But also, any important Republican in Washington had been swept out with Nixon's impeachment. So there's really no connected Republicans. And Paul Manafort and Roger Stone and Charlie Black, who at the time I think were 29, 30, and 31 years old, said, hey, you know, we can become lobbyists. And all of a sudden, they started signing up the marquee businesses of the 1980s. They represented TWA, they represented Salomon Brothers, they even represented Donald Trump.
You know, as I was reading the book, you talk about each of these men. I think it struck me that you could write a biography about each of them as a whole book. But let's share a little bit about you know, Manafort and Stone in particular, because their careers are so interesting.
They're really fascinating. And, you know, just to jump forward before jumping back, you know, Paul Manafort, we consider now to be someone who's sort of lost in Washington. You know, he went to jail. He's a convicted felon. He's been chewed up and spit out by Washington. But if Donald Trump wins, he's going to be back. He will certainly be the most powerful unelected Republican in Washington if Donald Trump wins. It's a pattern. He started really with the Reagan campaign, as we just talked about, that he had access to the Republican president back then that no one else had. Same way with Trump this time. But going back to his background, he's from Connecticut. He always wanted to be involved in politics. His family members were politicians in Connecticut. He came to Washington, D.C., went to Georgetown University, and very early on got a job working in the vice president's office, Gerald Ford's office at the time. Ford, as we know, after Watergate, all of a sudden was the Republican presidential nominee in 1976, squaring off in a contested election against, of all people, Ronald Reagan. At the time, Manafort was on the sort of establishment side, working for the vice president, trying to become, the then president, trying to win election for the first time and taking on the Reagan wing. After Reagan lost and Ford obviously lost to Carter, Manafort was sort of sent out into the wilderness. He had bet on Ford. Ford had lost. He all of a sudden was a big loser. And he saw his way back into the good grace of the Republican Party through Ronald Reagan. So he switched sides, jumped on Ronald Reagan's team, and the rest is history.
He does that a lot.
Yeah, Paul Manafort is one of these people in Washington who's a political animal. If you were to sit down with him and say, hey, what do you feel about, you know, immigration or tax reform or any major social or economic policy issue, I don't think he really has strong beliefs. He just wants to be with the winner. He wants power. He wants access. And for most of his career, he's bet on the right horse, and sometimes he bets on the wrong horse.
So I feel like we should, like, take a half step back just a second and say, like, what are the services that these lobbyists actually offered, and how did it sort of evolve?
Yeah. So our book is about two different things. One is about the rise of corporate power and the rise of corporate lobbying in D.C., in the last 50 years, but it's also about how lobbying has changed. So to answer your question, there's sort of two answers. One is that lobbying used to be, and I think what most people think lobbying is fat cat lobbyists who use campaign donations or rounds of golf or, you know, martinis to create relationships with powerful members of Congress and then get, you know, sweetheart deals for their clients. That is definitely how lobbying used to work. That's how Tommy Boggs was successful. And early on in the Reagan administration, that's certainly how Paul Manafort was successful. But lobbying now has started to move and evolve into a much more sophisticated game that's played more outside of Washington. And what I mean by that is that members of Congress are under so much scrutiny now by their political opponents and by the media that they're wary of doing favors for their lobbying buddies or their top fundraisers, because people like me would love to write a story about it. so instead, they try to follow what they think their constituents want, and lobbyists know that. So, you know, lobbyists know that members of Congress will do whatever 51% of their constituents want, and therefore a lot of lobbying takes place in the states or in the districts. If you want a member of Congress to support an immigration ban, then you go to that state and try to rally their consumers, you know, with pitches or letters or campaign or ads or social media ads against immigration. And if 51% of members of Congress's constituents are against immigration, then that's how that's where the members are going to be. So lobbies sort of are in a way, it's become more democratic. You're going out and trying to get Americans and voters to support or oppose various business issues.
And one of the things that was really interesting was watching you describe how these institutions evolved and went from sort of, you know, the original concepts that you talked about of representing client interests to elected members of Congress to adding sort of election services and then grassroots services. I mean, pretty soon you got a pretty complicated integrated company that is almost cradle to grave for these politicians.
Right, right. And it's a much... much more expensive too than just hiring a Tommy Boggs and having him go in and ask for a favor, you know. And a lot of our book is about that. It's sort of how things have changed, and the reason we picked the various people we write about over the years is that they show how lobbies changed along the way. So again, back to Tommy Boggs, if he was your inside guy, like you'd hire him, he'd take a pack check up to, you know, the Speaker of the House and try to get something for a client. Black Manafort and Stone, because they were campaign people, their whole lives they worked for Ronald Reagan and for other folks on campaign trails, they realized that, hey, you know, lobbying is more like a presidential campaign, as in if you need 51% of the votes in order to win. So they started trying to reach out a little bit more outside of Washington to influence Washington. And then folks we write about later on do that much more successfully.
And you also cover campaign finance laws and how they affect the power of the lobbyists.
Yeah, you know, there's been a, you know, one of the truisms in D.C. seems to be that every time there's a well-intentioned reform, it seems to backfire. And we write about a number of those examples in Washington. One way that lobbyists benefited from a well-intentioned reform was the 2002 McCain-Feingold campaign finance law. What that law sought to do was something very good, which was to get corporate money out of politics. At the time, companies and labor unions and individuals could donate unlimited sums of money, you know, make $1 million donations to the Democratic National Committee or the Republican National Committee. And Congress in 2002 said, hey, they shouldn't be allowed to do that, and ban that. But that meant that members of Congress and political parties needed to all of a sudden raise money in much smaller increments from individual executives or individual Americans or from corporate political action committees. And that was a lot of work. People like Tommy Boggs and some of the people who came after him realized that, you know, they were sort of great sources of money for these politicians, because Tommy Boggs had 100 clients. And if he had 100 executives and each one of them wrote a $5,000 check, well, all of a sudden that's starting to match, you know, the $1 million checks that the political parties used to be able to get from big companies. So while this law banned companies from giving money to politics, which was a good thing, it elevated the role of lobbyists in fundraising, which means all of a sudden members of Congress sort of needed lobbyists to help them raise money. And obviously that's a bad thing for our country if a member of Congress is reliant on a lobbyist to run for reelection, because then they're dependent on lobbyists, and lobbyists can get what they want.
Let's talk about Tony Podesta. He starts out as this, you know, idealistic liberal activist, but he gets involved in Teddy Kennedy's campaign to oppose Robert Bork. Can you describe what happened there, and how did he evolve from there?
Yeah, so Tony Podesta is a fascinating character. Much like Tommy Boggs, he is raised, you know, as a liberal Democrat. He came from Chicago. He was very involved in Democratic politics from an early age. In college, he was the president of the college Democrats. And then he came to Washington, and starting from 1964 on, he has worked for, volunteered for, every major Democrat running for president from then until now. And, you know, his first clients were big Democratic organizations like Planned Parenthood, and he helped start the first Earth Day in Washington. You know, so he's a liberal Democrat. And then he sort of switches, and he started as a switch around the time that he works on the 1987 Bork nomination. So to roll back the clock then, you know, Ronald Reagan is president. The Christian right has very strong influence in his administration, and Ronald Reagan nominates Robert Bork to be a Supreme Court justice in the summer of 1987, I believe it was. And at the time, Tony Podesta was working for a group called People for the American Way, which was a small organization funded by the Hollywood screenwriter and producer Norman Lear, and they were founded in order to head off or reduce or counteract the influence of the Christian right in politics. At the time, the Christian right had lots of influence around the country and in Washington, you know, banning books, trying to get people to boycott movies that didn't follow the Christian values that they prescribed. Tony Podesta was on the other side of that, working against it for this group called People for the American Way. And what he realized was he didn't have the money or the power that the Christian right had, but what he did have was access to the media and the support of the American people. So he went out and tried to rally regular Americans against policies proposed by the Christian right and against, you know, book banning. He was able to use the media to get influence among regular Americans because he didn't have the money to make campaign checks or to hire lobbyists. So along comes Reagan's nomination of Robert Bork in 1987, and the committee that was reviewing the all Supreme Court nominations is the Senate Judiciary Committee, at the time actually headed by a guy named Joe Biden. But also very influential on that committee was Ted Kennedy. Ted Kennedy ran the opposition to Judge Bork and hired Tony Podesta because he had seen how well Tony Podesta had used grassroots and used regular Americans to shift policy against the Christian right in Washington. So he hired Tony Podesta, and Tony Podesta goes out and digs up all sorts of information about Judge Bork's record that most Americans wouldn't like. They started literally running campaign ads against Judge Bork. So if you watch the Supreme Court battles in Washington these days, they're all based off of what Tony Podesta did back then. Before Podesta and Kennedy and Biden went after Judge Bork in 1987, the country had a history of just letting the president nominate basically whoever he wanted for big judicial appointments. This is the first time that a Supreme Court fight became, you know, a huge political campaign, and almost every judicial nomination since then has been the same.
And Podesta goes on to a long career that ends up sort of tragically, doesn't it?
Yeah. So after the Bork nomination, he and his brother John Podesta started a lobbying firm. We asked him why, you know, after so many years working for these liberal causes and working for Democratic presidents, did he switch and become a corporate lobbyist? And he said, well, the companies paid him more. So as a result of that, he starts a lobbying firm. He starts representing a lot of Hollywood companies and then later pharmaceutical companies and tech companies and Google. And he becomes an incredibly important lobbyist in D.C., you know, sort of the modern version of Tommy Boggs. When Hillary Clinton was running for president in 2016, he's expected, you know, Hillary Clinton was obviously expected to beat Donald Trump. Tony Podesta had probably the third or fourth largest lobbying firm in D.C. at the time. And he basically said, you know, Hillary's going to win. I'm going to be your connection to Hillary. Hillary lost, which was, you know, a problem for him, but not the biggest problem. A bigger problem for him is that he became a center focus of the Mueller investigation. Unbeknownst to people years earlier, Tony Podesta had gone into business, in fact, with Paul Manafort, representing the pro-Russian president of Ukraine. When Trump won, Mueller started investigating Trump's ties to Russia, whether Russia had influenced the election at all on behalf of Trump. That investigation led to Paul Manafort, who was representing the pro-Russian president of Ukraine at the time. Turns out that that Manafort had hired Tommy Boggs or Tony Podesta. They had not properly disclosed the work they were doing, and as a result of that, Paul Manafort went to jail, and Tony Podesta got, you know, pretty close to going to jail. So that resulted in the collapse of his lobbying firm.
And there's another fascinating relationship that you cover, Evan Morris and Jim Kordovich. And their ultimately, I guess, tragic story. Did you want to touch on that?
Yeah, it is tragic. So, you know, back to the beginning, you know, we're talking about how lobbying has changed and moved from this insider game of Tommy Boggs to the outsider game. And Evan Morris and Jim Kordovich were masters of the outside game. They used media strategies and other campaign tactics to get the American people to support this policy or that policy, and therefore get members of Congress to follow. What we found out, though, is that there's a huge a problem in that sort of outside lobbying area, and that is that there's no disclosure. So, you know, traditional lobbyists like Tommy Boggs, when they go up to Capitol Hill and lobby, they need to fill out a quarterly report that says who their name is, who they're representing, how much money they're making, and the American people and the media and the clients can read that and see what their lobbyists are up to. Lobbying that takes place outside of Washington, focusing on the constituents, is not, there are no rules for disclosure. In the case of Evan Morris, who is a big-time lobbyist for a Genentech, a big biotech company, he was spending millions and millions of dollars on these outside lobbying tactics. One of his consultants was this guy named Jim Kordovich, who is a media strategist, and there was so little disclosure of the money that Evan Morris was spending that at some point he and Jim Kordovich started just passing the money back and forth. They basically created some fake lobbying companies, fake offshoots, and just started sending money back and forth. So Evan Morris would hire Jim Kordovich for $3 million to perform some nebulous task, and Jim Kordovich would take roughly half the money and send it back to Evan Morris's bank account. And they went on for a decade passing money back and forth like that before they got caught.
And of course, ultimately, the story ends in the vignette that you opened the book with.
Yeah, so, you know, the topics that we're talking about, lobbying, campaign finance, corporate power, you know, these are super interesting to me, but, you know, pretty dense topics, especially for folks outside of D.C. who don't live and breathe politics. So the way we try to tell this story is through really interesting characters like the people we're talking about. And Evan Morris, to us, seemed like the most tragic figure. He ended up dead on a golf course in 2015. And what we realized is that telling the story about Evan Morris's rise and fall, how he came to Washington, how he amassed power, how he became so successful in Washington, and then tragically, you know, how he died and ended up dead on a golf course, telling that story really tells the readers how Washington now works or doesn't work. So we open with Evan Morris on this golf course, and the whole book is sort of set up as a mystery, like how did this guy get there? And along the way, we're going to teach you about how Washington has changed, how power has changed, and how corporations have taken so much, have gained so much influence in Washington.
Let's do a quick case study. How are the tools deployed by Google to defeat the PIPA? And I've forgotten what that stands for.
Yeah, SOPA PIP, right.
How is that emblematic of the modern corporate lobbying campaign?
Yeah, so great question. So, you know, we're not writing a history of lobbying. We skip lots of things. What we are doing is we write about key moments when companies found a new tactic or embraced a new strategy in order to become more influential. And a good case study we use is a fight in 2012 between Google and the tech industry and larger copyright companies in Washington like the Chamber of Commerce, the pharmaceutical industry, Hollywood, the radio industry, the music industry. And what was going on back then, and Rupert Murdoch, I should say, of News Corp. And, you know, it's hard to remember back just in 2012, not that long ago, but Google and the tech industry were really upstarts at the time. They did not have much influence in Washington. They just started coming to Washington. They weren't making that many campaign donations. But the bigger companies, Hollywood in particular, saw the threat that the tech industry would someday create, you know, and they were right that you know, the tech platforms allow people to share sometimes, you know, illegally downloaded movies or music online without paying the copyright holder. So these big companies like Rupert Murdoch, Murdoch's News Corp, and Hollywood created a bill called the Stop Online Piracy Act, which essentially would require Google and other internet players to police for the first time some of the content that users put on their websites. Google and the upstart companies thought this bill would destroy the internet. You know, it definitely would not have destroyed the internet. It certainly would have made it harder for them to grow and would have cost them more money. But anyway, they started a campaign and said, you know, this bill will kill the internet. Nevertheless, the bill had huge support in both sides of Congress. In the Senate at one point, 99 out of 100 senators supported the bill. The numbers were similar in the House. The supporters of the legislation, the industries that back the legislation, like Hollywood and News Corp and the pharmaceutical industry and the Chamber of Commerce, spent almost $100 million lobbying for the bill. And the tech industry just didn't have that kind of money or resources or lobbyists. At some point, the tech industry and Google realized, hey, we don't have the money to fight head on. but we have all these internet users. So they picked a day, which was January 18th, 2012, I believe, and they staged a protest called the Shut Down the Internet Day, where on that day, hundreds and thousands of websites, including Google, either shut down for the day or put a banner on their website that said, hey, Congress is trying to kill the internet. They're proposing this bill. Votes are coming soon. You know, call your member of Congress, tell them that they shouldn't kill the internet, and tell them to not support the bill. And within hours, millions and millions and millions of Americans had either called their member of Congress or emailed their member of Congress, and that bill, which the day before had the support of 99 out of 100 senators, was dead within 2 days. And what that showed is a couple things. One is the power that companies could have by getting regular Americans to come in and sort of lobby on their behalf. So that was a huge pivot point. But also that was the day that these upstart tech companies, you know, Google and Facebook were relatively small. That's the day they became big tech. At that point, they were the most powerful lobby in D.C. Hollywood and the music industry really lost influence that day. And more importantly, more broadly, companies realize if they can rally their constituents, their business owners, or regular Americans to support policies or oppose policies that they oppose in Washington, that they're going to win, or they can win.
You know, early in the book, you talk about the history of the countervailing forces that surrounded Washington before the 1970s. Do you see any possibility of that stance sort of returning?
So that's a great question. It has a little bit of a complicated answer, but let's just do a little history first. So, as you say, the founding fathers foresaw that laws and legislation in Washington would not be created in a vacuum, or in government, I should say. There was no Washington at the time. They knew that that there would be other forces on government policy. Those forces, they predicted, would be a pro-industry group and a pro-worker group. Today we call them lobbyists or interest groups. The founding fathers called them factions, but it's all sort of the same idea. And what they saw or predicted is that the industry faction would fight against the worker faction, and they would sort of be of equal sizes and strengths and sort of push against each other to create sort of compromise legislation that both could support. And for most of our country's history until the 1970s, that was really the case. Think about the 1960s and 70s. Ralph Nader and consumer groups had incredible power in Washington. I mean, Ralph Nader took on General Motors when General Motors was, when the motto was "What's good for GM is good for the country," and Ralph Nader took them on auto safety and won. And that shows, one, how influential Ralph Nader was in consumer groups, but also how little influence until the 1970s General Motors had. So cut to now. So I guess since the 1970s, companies have just poured money into Washington, poured investments into Washington, hired tons of lobbyists, made tons of campaign donations, and they have now become by far the most powerful faction in Washington. And more importantly, they've sort of neutered all the other factions. I mean, environmental groups have very little influence. As we know, labor unions are, barely exist and have very little political pull in Washington. And consumer groups, barely exist also. Companies have all the power. So now we get to the question, is there a silver lining? Is there something that could change this? And I think the answer is yes, although we'll have to see. There seem to be more, in the last 5 years, more and more Democrats and Republicans who are coming out against corporate America, who are bashing companies.
Brody, I got to stop you. We're going to run into a wall. I appreciate you spending time with us today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.